The gun violence marches are over. How do young people keep up their momentum?
I don't want to live in a world where I go to school and I have no idea if that's going to be me. I don't know. I have two younger sisters. I don't know if that's going to be them. I don't want to worry if that's the last time I'm going to see them.
Students are trying to keep up the pressure on leaders after the massacre at a high school in Florida. Also, another alleged chemical weapons attack in Syria.
The videos seem pretty convincing that these people did not die in bombings or anything else, and that they did die from some form of chemical.
What an American response to chemical weapons means to the world, and also how one broadcasting company created an empire out of local news stations.
Local TV news was sort of the last man standing as far as local journalism goes.
This is The Takeaway for Monday, April 9th, 2018.
Having this town hall meeting because this is an issue that has not gone away.
I believe in myself, I believe in the other students, and I believe that if we keep pushing, we're definitely going to make a change. We already are. All the students from Parkland, they're all making a change. I think change is happening.
I say, if I don't talk about poverty, if I don't talk about race, if I don't talk about gun violence, I have lost no matter the results of the election.
I don't want to live in a world where I go to school and I have no idea if that's going to be me. I don't know. I have two younger sisters. I don't know if that's going to be them. I don't want to worry if that's the last time I'm going to see them.
If they won't act for us, we'll act for ourselves.
Students are trying to keep gun violence at the top of the American agenda. You're hearing sound there from town halls all across the country over the last week, organized by students who are part of a movement responding to the shooting in February at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Florida.
But I'm going to tell you something. I do have the courage to be here. I am the only Republican.
I think we should have mandatory waiting periods. Everyone's used to the idea of Amazon saying, you know, two-day shipping, and you're going to wait for 2 days. We're all okay with that, so why not mandatory waiting periods for firearms?
Some confrontational moments from a town hall in Michigan over the weekend at the end there. According to the Town Hall Project, there were 120 events of this kind across the country over this past Saturday alone. And that's where we start on The Takeaway today. I'm Todd Zwilling. Tyler Scott is a reporter for Michigan Public Radio. He attended that town hall that you just heard a piece of in Oakland County in Michigan's 11th Congressional District on Saturday. Tyler, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
Also with us, Katie Switalski, a reporter with WLRN News in Miami, who also went to a town hall last week in Coral Springs, Florida, just down the road from Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, where 17 people were killed in February. Katie, thanks to you.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Katie, let me start with you there in Florida. You attended that town hall last week in Coral Springs, Florida, like I said. What happened?
Congressman Ted Deutsch, who is Parkland and Coral Springs congressman, hosted a town hall with local officials, and most of the questions were asked by Marjory Stoneman Douglas students. There was a lot of disappointment that Broward County school board members weren't in attendance. They had their own regularly scheduled meeting to attend instead. But the crowd was very energetic. It was a packed theater in Coral Springs. And a lot of the kids were asking questions about mental health, the clear backpack restrictions, more school security rules, but also what's going to happen after summer break and after the town decides really how it wants to harden these schools security-wise.
And did they get any answers from public officials when they asked those questions?
They did get some answers. For instance, Lenore Munoz, she's a graduating senior at Marjory Stoneman Douglas. And she was more concerned about, you know, now that the weeks are going by, mental health resources for students are fading.
It seems like every day that I go to school, there's less and less help. More teachers expect us to move on. There are less counselors, and all of them are in the library. The therapy dogs are gone, basically. There's only a few that follow specific students. And it's right around this time when the shock has worn off and the depression is setting in.
So she actually got a few answers from officials, and they basically told her and other students, you know, there are going to be more resources for you. You can use things like, you know, the Broward County 211 hotline or wait for us to train more psychologists.
Tyler Scott, let's go to your neighborhood in southeastern Michigan, there where you attended a town hall in Michigan's 11th congressional district. This is Wayne County and Oakland County, just outside of Detroit. What happened at the town hall that you went to?
Well, it was somewhat interesting because the sitting congressman in that district is Republican Dave Trott, and he was invited, according to one of the organizers, Nash Salome, who's a 16-year-old high school student down the road in Canton, Michigan. Trott didn't come. He's not seeking re-election to the seat. None of the Republican candidates who organizers said were invited came either. What we ended up with was five Democratic candidates and a packed room full of people at the library.
So, Tyler, I don't know if that's coincidence or if there's a sense that public outrage over gun violence is actually going to play a significant part in the 2018 elections coming up. You went to a town hall where no Republicans turned up and five Democrats thought this was a good idea for them to be there.
Yeah, and I don't know. We saw like this in the town halls, like right after President Trump came into office, where there was these town halls where GOP members of Congress either wouldn't come to town halls or would come and they would just face pretty resentful, angry crowds. And that might have been a little bit of gaming because the crowd at the town hall for Novi was mostly, you know, pro gun control reform, pro something needs to be done. So I don't know why exactly GOP members may not have came, but it was would have been somewhat of a hostile room for them.
And Tyler, what did the Democrats who did attend that town hall have to say?
Yeah, I'll start with Dan Haberman. He's one of the candidates for the race, and he opened up. Everybody gave their opening statement, and he kind of opened up with a nod to Nash, the 16-year-old student who helped bring the town hall together and get it organized, and just said that, like, look, these kids who are caring about these issues are sort of stirring up some attention for an issue that needs to be talked about a lot.
We are in a time now where we've got such an opportunity to get behind the students who are standing up for all of us. And the technique they're using is brilliant. It's shame. They're shaming these folks who for so long haven't done the easy and right thing to do.
And like I said, most of the crowd was very in support of many of the things the Democratic candidates had to say on gun control reforms. But there was a sometimes vocal contingent of people who seemed to be more pro-gun ownership type of folks who weren't necessarily causing trouble, but there was a sort of interesting moment where it seems like one guy may have been open carrying a pistol. I didn't visually confirm that or was able to confirm that in any way, but there was a sort of a ruckus as people came to the mic to start asking questions at the end. Somebody was standing in line. One woman noticed it looked like one guy was carrying open carry pistol and was surprised that he had it in the library.
So, Katie, this was sort of an early town hall, and you talked about the Town Hall for Our Lives movement, trying to keep the momentum going for all of the protests and media attention that we've seen. What sense did you get from students there about their strategy of keeping this issue in the news? Because there's always the risk that eventually the media and the attention moves on.
It goes away. So I think these kids in particular are looking to do more for our lives movements. This town hall project for our lives was something where after all of the national March for Our Lives media coverage died down and that event passed, these students said, okay, next congressional recess, when you're back in your districts, we challenge you to have these town halls with your community. So after this and after these town halls, when Congress goes back, I think it's something that Stoneman Douglas students are looking to keep lobbying their local officials. I know, especially in Parkland and Coral Springs, I mean, the Broward County School Board is slammed right now with requests to meet with students and get answers to some of the harder security questions. And Marjorie Stoneman Douglas is a school that has now been, you know, they've had a lot of security changes in the past couple of weeks with a police tower, you know, ID badges, clear backpacks, and students are upset. You know, they want they've found very creative civil disobedience ways to poke fun at these clear backpacks. But what they're really trying to tell the local officials is, you know, listen to what we want instead of giving us your ideas.
Tyler, certainly the issue of the shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School has hit the community squarely in Florida. But what about where you are in Michigan? How has this issue hit home?
Well, it's interesting because in the weeks since that shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, there's been dozens and dozens of threats at schools, kids over social media in a lot of cases, or overheard at school making threatening comments. And all of those have been false threats. There haven't been any incidents. But there was a day a few weeks ago where two dozen schools in Detroit alone shut down because of somewhat credible threats or threats that had to be investigated. So the issue of gun violence and gun control in the wake of the school shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas is definitely on everybody's mind, and it's affecting students in a lot of ways, even if they're not thinking politically about what needs to happen in office. You know, it's there. It's in the culture. It's something people are talking about and affected by.
So, Tyler, Katie talked about momentum in Florida and the desire for students to, frankly, stay relevant in politics, even if the media moves on. What about 1,300 miles away in Michigan, where this mass shooting didn't happen in the backyard, but students still want to be relevant in the debate?
Like I said, there was a 16-year-old Nash Salami who helped organize this town hall Saturday. He was, as far as I could tell, the only student involved in organizing, and there wasn't a big, strong, or present, or vocal group of students at the town hall. But when the March for Our Lives events happened a few weeks ago at high schools all across Southeast Michigan here, there were student-led marches and protests and students giving speech on the steps of their high school, et cetera. So I think there is a lot of interest. I think it's, students might be trying to figure out how much they care and how they get involved on an individual basis. Nash, the 16-year-old who organized this one Saturday, is super involved politically. On his Facebook page, he's got pictures with Joe Biden and stuff like that. He's been interested in politics for a long time.
And Katie, let me leave it with you as we talk about the future from Coral Springs and your neighborhood there in Florida. Do the politicians and the public leaders there have a sense that the students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, who've become so prominent in the media, are really a political force to be reckoned with?
I really think so. I think it's, the sense that these kids are not going to stop, and whether there's media there or not, they're still going to be meeting with their local politicians and state politicians and calling meetings with whoever they can, because they really think that, and even the graduating seniors, they have a great concern for the current freshmen and the incoming freshmen, those students who are eighth graders now thinking, oh no, I have to go to high school here next year. They're focused more on what can we do for these kids, because we get to graduate, but we need to take care of the ones coming in. And I think that sense is very strong. And I think whether that translates to more town hall meetings or private meetings, you're going to see a lot more movement from these kids as politicians start to really take them seriously.
That's Katie Switalski with WLRN News in Miami. Katie, thanks.
Thank you.
And also Tyler Scott at Michigan Radio. Tyler, thanks to you.
Thanks, Tom.
I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway. Photos and videos of adults and children sprawled on floors and in stairwells circulated widely this past weekend, suggesting another chemical weapons attack by the Assad regime in Syria. Those images have not been independently verified, but the alleged attack took place in Douma, the last rebel-held town in eastern Ghouta, just 12 miles east of Damascus. The Takeaway spoke with Dr. Jad Salem, a board member of the Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations International in Dubai, who's been in touch with doctors on the ground in Ghouta.
So this is the first time in Ghouta since 2013 where people are killed in such a horrible way. People are asphyxiated to death. You could see in their bodies the suffering, cyanosis, change of color, prominent eyes. Like, it's a horrible form of dying. We cannot afford, we human being, that somebody kill our fellow human in such a horrible way.
Aid groups reported that more than 40 people suffocated and said symptoms were consistent with nerve or chlorine gas exposure. I spoke with Liz Sly, who's the Beirut bureau chief for The Washington Post.
It's extremely difficult to confirm absolutely that it is a chemical attack, because the place where this took place, eastern Ghouta, is completely surrounded by government troops. There haven't been Western journalists there in years. And in recent weeks, as the government's been advancing towards it, a lot of the media activists who normally put out a lot of materials about these things have themselves been evacuating under various deals aimed at securing their surrender. And we haven't even had as much material on this attack as we usually get. But the videos seem pretty convincing that these people did not die in bombings or anything else, that there were large numbers of bodies piled up in basements and in like what looks like inside rooms they were sheltering from the bombing, and that they did die from some form of chemical.
Have you managed to hear anything from sources on the ground, from victims or families or people who you keep in touch with?
What we've heard is from the rescue workers that they found these people after a seemingly fairly large device was dropped by a helicopter and it landed on a building. It went through the roof of a building and appears to have spilled some kind of toxic gas into the building, and that the people inside suffocated from whatever the substance was that was released.
Liz, the Assad government has denied the use of chemicals here, and Russia, of course, their key ally, has supported that denial. How credible are those claims?
Well, they've denied all the chemical attacks that have happened, and there's been a lot of investigations into this from the United Nations, and they've all come up with pretty conclusive evidence that the Assad regime has used gas, so we kind of would expect them to deny it, because they always do.
Liz, you mentioned some of the photos and videos that the outside world has seen of apparent victims. We've seen graphic photos and videos over the weekend of young children lying on the floor, many with serious injuries, their eyes burning, apparently children crying. Who were the apparent victims of this attack? You mentioned that a canister was dropped on a building. Is there any idea why these particular people appear to have been targeted?
Well, in all the attacks, all the chemical attacks we've seen, it's been civilians who got hit. There were a lot of civilians, maybe 100,000 civilians living cramped in a very tiny area, surrounded by government forces with the rebels inside. The government has been bombarding them randomly and without discrimination for rebels or military target or civilian targets for weeks and weeks now. And well over 1,000 people have died in that bombing. So it does look like they were just fulfilling the military target that they have, which is to empty the area. They want to finish the battle. The rebels there have been refusing to do a deal. Hours after their chemical attack yesterday, they did say they would surrender, and they started leaving the area today. So it does look like militarily it might have been quite a successful tactical use of a chemical weapon to force the capitulation of rebels living in an area where there are many civilians who are the ones suffering from the fighting.
And can you put this in context of the larger war, Liz? Douma and Eastern Ghouta, the apparent surrender of rebels in that area, as you said, how does this fit into the broader campaign?
Well, it fits into the broad trajectory of the Assad regime's victory over the rebels, which has been very slow in coming. It's taken 7 years and it's not over yet. But block by block, city by city, town by town, they are taking back the areas that turned against Assad in 2011. And this is a big victory for them because it's the biggest area outside Damascus, the capital, that had fallen under rebel control. And they've been unable to take it till now. But now they've pretty much secured the perimeter of the capital. And there's really no major threat left to Assad in Damascus.
Liz Sly, Beirut Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. Liz, thank you.
Thank you.
We go now to Robert Ford, who served as ambassador to Syria from 2011 to 2014. He's currently a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute and Yale University. Ambassador, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Well, Ambassador, President Trump said on Twitter yesterday that President Putin, Russia, and Iran are responsible for backing Animal Assad. Big price to pay. Those are the president's words. Now, it got a lot of attention, primarily, it seems, because it was the first time that the president had criticized Vladimir Putin by name. But is there a coherent message from President Trump about what exactly that means, big price to pay?
Well, I think the entire world is wondering what President Trump means by it. I think everyone is wondering whether or not there will be some kind of American military strike. Right now, it's not yet clear.
Well, what are the realistic options for a response?
I think it is possible to deter Bashar al-Assad from using chemical weapons. President Trump launched a heavy strike a year ago, and for a time, the Syrian government stopped using chemical weapons. But the Syrian government is such that it always tests to find out where's the edge of the envelope. So after that last American strike a year ago, it waited a few months. Then it used a small amount of chemical weapons over here and a small amount over there and gradually built up a little more here, a little more there, testing. The Americans didn't do anything. So if we want to deter the Syrian government from using chemical weapons, we have to strike them each time they test us even a little bit until Assad understands that the Americans will react, and he thinks twice, and he thinks even three times before he tells his military to use chemical weapons.
Ambassador, didn't the United States signal a long time ago that it had already acquiesced to the Assad regime, that even if there are strikes in response to a chemical weapons attack, I mean, there's a criticism that those strikes would simply be a cost of doing business. A base gets destroyed, a factory gets destroyed, and Assad remains.
Well, I think we need to separate two different foreign policy objectives. One is removing Bashar al-Assad from power, and I'm in the camp that argues that that is no longer possible for us to achieve. He's distasteful, but he's going to stay. He's captured the major population centers. But there's a second foreign policy objective, which is to deter the use of chemical weapons in Syria, and do it in such a way that dictators and authoritarian governments in other parts of the world who are certainly watching Syria also are deterred from using chemical weapons.
Now, there's been plenty of criticism of President Trump that the actual message has been quite the opposite to the one that you're advocating, Ambassador, because just prior to this attack, President Trump announced that he was considering withdrawing all U.S. troops from Syria. And John McCain, among other people, said that that very announcement has given Assad the green light for atrocities like this, knowing the Americans are on the way out. How do you view it?
Well, with all due respect to Senator McCain, who truly is an American hero, but with all due respect to him, I think he's quite wrong. The Syrian government has been using chemical weapons, as I said, regularly during this 7-year conflict, using it regularly. They didn't start after Trump said he was going to withdraw U.S. forces from Syria. They'd been using it long before that. So I think it is important for America to be realistic about what it can achieve in Syria. I know Senator McCain would like to compel Assad to leave power, but short of a massive U.S. intervention that likely would require ground forces and would put us directly eyeball to eyeball in confrontation with Russian forces deployed now in Syria, there is no way for the Americans to compel Bashar al-Assad to leave the Syrian presidential palace. We have to be realistic about that.
Ambassador, talk about what's at stake outside of these two countries, the long-term damage to the norms against the use of chemical weapons, and how important an American response is here.
Well, that, I think, is the underlying American national security interest with respect to the use of chemical weapons in Syria. It is, of course, a moral outrage, and no one who sees these pictures of Syrian civilian dead can help but being moved by them. But dating back to World War I, when we had tens of thousands of American soldiers killed and in many cases permanently injured because of chemical weapons use on the battlefronts in World War I, there has been an international consensus that chemical weapons should not be used. And there have been occasions here and there since then. Saddam Hussein, for example, used them against the Kurds in Iraq. But for the most part, that consensus has held, that agreement. And I fear that Assad's using chemical weapons regularly, very visibly, and with basically impunity, threatens that consensus in a way we have not seen since World War I.
Robert Ford, ambassador to Syria from 2011 to 2014, currently with the Middle East Institute and Yale University. Ambassador, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
All All right, folks, we're covering Mark Zuckerberg tomorrow, and it's time for a little bit of takeaway audience participation here. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, of course, will testify before a House committee tomorrow. He's going to answer questions about how Cambridge Analytica was able to get the personal data of about 90 million Facebook users. On Wednesday, we're going to be talking about your personal data and what Facebook does and doesn't have. And if you're concerned about your data, we want to help. Go to our Twitter or Facebook pages, and at the top of those pages, we have instructions on how you can download your data. Do that before Wednesday, and we'll explain what you're looking at and how to better protect yourself if you're worried that your data is in the hands of companies like Facebook. Again, go to our Facebook or Twitter page and find instructions on how you can download your data from Facebook. We have an immigration story now, but not one involving people even coming from outside the United States. The country's debating who can come over the borders here and become an American citizen, of course. But American Samoans are born on U.S. soil. They pay taxes, but they can't vote, they can't serve on a jury, and they can't run for office. In other words, they're not automatically U.S. citizens. American Samoa is a cluster of islands about 2,500 miles southwest of Hawaii. It's been a U.S. territory since 1900. If you're from one of the other four U.S. territories, we're talking Guam, the Northern Mariana Islands, Puerto Rico, the U.S. Virgin Islands, you're automatically a U.S. citizen when you're born. But for American Samoans, you can only claim citizenship at birth if you have one parent who's already a U.S. citizen. And while American Samoans do have American passports, it very clearly states...
Currently, it's stating that I'm a U.S. national instead of a U.S. citizen.
That's John Fitisamanu. He was born in American Samoa. Today, he lives and works in Utah. He's the lead plaintiff on a lawsuit challenging for birthright American citizenship for people born in American Samoa.
I pay taxes, and I've been working here in the United States for a long time, but I'm not a U.S. citizen.
And Neil Weir is the attorney leading that lawsuit. He's president and founder of the nonprofit Equally American.
Yeah, the federal government's position is that the question of citizenship in U.S. territories is left entirely up to Congress. And that contradicts the text and history of the Citizenship Clause of the 14th Amendment, which affirms that people born anywhere on U.S. soil, whether in a state, a territory, the District of Columbia, have an individual constitutional right to be recognized as citizens that Congress or other elected officials can't take away from them. And so that's what we're asking for the court to recognize here.
John, what has this meant for you in your life? Clearly, you have the ability to work in the United States. You work in Utah. You pay taxes. Obviously, you don't have the right to vote. That's a big deal. What else has this meant to your life?
Yeah, I've been thinking about it for a long time and contemplating the question of why can I vote? You know, I have relatives that are born in American Samoa, and they join the armed forces, and they're not equal to others born in the United States when it comes to citizenship.
So, Neil, you found your plaintiff here, but this isn't the first time you've tried in a case like this.
Yeah, we've represented other American Samoans in a previous case, and since the Supreme Court declined to review that earlier case, we've actually heard from more than 500 American Samoans living throughout 40 different states and territories who want to be recognized as citizens without being required to go through the naturalization process. These are the only passport-holding, tax-paying Americans who are asked to take a test and pay a fee in order to be recognized as citizens and enjoy the same rights as other Americans. And we think that's not just morally wrong, but also unconstitutional.
Now, John, Neil raises an important point here, which is that you could apply for naturalization and to be a full U.S. citizen. That's available to American Samoans. Why not just do that?
I think it's a matter of principle. I shouldn't have to jump through any hoops to recognize as equally American when I was born in a U.S. territory of the United States of America.
So, Neil, what have the appeals courts said about this issue of whether it's basically capricious to allow Congress to decide which people born in U.S. territories are citizens in some cases and not citizens in others? Because it's a little hard to square how people from Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands and even the District of Columbia, where I live, are citizens when they're born and people like John aren't.
Yeah, the D.C. Circuit relied on a very expansive interpretation of the Insular cases, a series of controversial Supreme Court cases about the territories decided by the same court that decided Plessy versus Ferguson, to really say these issues, these questions are completely up to Congress. And that squarely contradicts both the text and the purpose of the 14th Amendment, which was ratified shortly after the Civil War to overturn the Dred Scott decision and to make it clear that citizenship by birth on U.S. soil was a fundamental right in the Constitution and not one that Congress has discretion over, and that that would be the case not just in the states, but also in the U.S. territories, which at the time constituted nearly half the land area of the United States.
Well, John, talk about your family members and your friends back home in American Samoa. Some of them are citizens, I suppose. Others are not. What do people say when they talk about this?
Some are upset. I mean, a majority of the people that I associate with are upset that we have to go through this process in order for us to be recognized as a naturalized U.S. citizen or being born in U.S. territory and not being recognized as U.S. citizens. And others are, you know, they just don't want to, you know, change. So they just want to stay their status now.
There are people you know in American Samoa who are satisfied with the way things are now.
Yeah, there are some, yes.
Neil, you mentioned some of the bills before Congress pertaining to birthright citizenship now. And it strikes me that if a case like yours ever reached the Supreme Court, you know, these things have a way of being much broader than the original case. This might not be about American Samoa in the end, really at all, or at least not just about that. You're asking the courts to lay down a definition of the 14th Amendment that probably a lot of lawmakers, conservative Republican lawmakers, won't like. They would like to restrict the definition of birthright citizenship right now.
Yeah, fortunately, the Supreme Court has weighed in, you know, three times in the past to support recognition of birthright citizenship in the territories. And so we're confident that should this ever get to the Supreme Court, they'll take a serious look at what the Constitution requires and follow its mandates.
And Neil, is there a practical consideration here if the courts ruled in your favor in this case and all of a sudden 30 or 35,000 American Samoans became U.S. citizens in the blink of an eye?
Well, we're just asking the courts to recognize that they already are citizens and have been really since the day they were born. That's what the Constitution requires. But there is a practical consequence. I mean, there are very important elections coming up in 2018. John will certainly be impacted by the results of those elections, both at a national level, but also in his now home state of Utah. And he, like every other American, should have the ability to vote for the representatives that make the laws they have to follow. And so our hope is that we can get a positive resolution for John and the others we represent ahead of the 2018 elections, but certainly ahead of the upcoming 2020 presidential elections.
Neil Weir is the lead attorney in a lawsuit asking for 14th Amendment rights, birthright citizenship for citizens of American Samoa. He's president and founder of the nonprofit Equally American. Neil, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And John Fitisimanu is the lead plaintiff in that case, born in American Samoa. John, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Do you trust your local TV news?
This is Mariah from Park City, Utah. I choose not to watch local news on television, not because I don't trust them, but because I find local providers less interesting and full of water skiing squirrel fluff.
This is John from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm less likely to believe it immediately if the station is trying to get a scoop and trying to be the first to report something.
I do not watch television news, nor do I trust it. Local television news, like its cable counterpart, has devolved into an echo chamber of fear-mongering and entertainment.
I tune into local news periodically, but after learning about Sinclair Broadcasting's attempt to distort the content, I'll be checking to see what local stations they may own before watching in the future. This is Susan Loger in Portland, Oregon.
Now, lots of you say you don't trust the local news in your community, and a recent viral video made by Deadspin has brought a lot of attention to one big media company that owns a lot of little local stations. They are Sinclair Broadcasting Group.
Hi, I'm Fox San Antonio's Jessica Headley.
And I'm Ryan Wolf.
Our greatest responsibility is to serve our Treasure Valley communities.
The El Paso, Las Cruces communities.
Eastern Iowa communities.
The sharing of biased and false news has become all too common on social media.
Well, that video, that mashup has been a sensation online because of what it illustrates. How are all those local news anchors saying exactly the same thing? Well, Sinclair has been buying up those local TV stations and then feeding them editorial scripts pushing a conservative agenda. We reached out to dozens of local journalists at Sinclair-owned stations about this phenomenon, and we got this comment from someone in a local newsroom. The message of the promo was meant at a local level. Never mentions national outlets or attacks any specific organization. Any person with any bias can skew it to seem one way or the other, but my viewer at home sitting on his or her couch can rest assured that I'm doing my job. Well, that promo isn't the only example of how Sinclair shapes coverage. Take this example from last week, a must-run segment titled internally, Media Bashing of the Sinclair Broadcasting Group, with Boris Epstein. He's the chief political analyst for Sinclair and a former official in the Trump campaign and the Trump administration.
In terms of my analysis playing during your local news, as you see, my segments are very clearly marked as commentary. The same cannot be said for cable and broadcast news hosts who inject their opinions and bias into news coverage all the time without drawing any lines between them.
That same source who wrote to us before from a local newsroom said this about what you just heard. I think it's safe to say that there's a general disdain for Boris's commentary pieces every day. We do our best to overemphasize that it's commentary. Well, local news stations are supposed to fulfill a mission of local coverage from their communities, but Sinclair seems to be making national politics a central part of its local coverage. Philip Napoli is a professor at Duke Sanford School of Public Policy who studies local television.
We've really taken another step forward in the level of centralization of operations that can take place in how large station groups manage their stations. There's been that type of centralization in other aspects of how the stations have operated, centralized weather reports, things of that sort. But to see the same content distributed across identically across so many stations was really a step further.
Now, why is this important? Because certainly the big cable networks, CNN and Fox and the others, they have centralized operations by definition. So Why is it an issue if local stations do it?
Well, our local stations have historically been regulated under a principle called localism. That's something that's a key part of the FCC's public interest regulatory framework that they apply to broadcast television. And so we've had a whole different host of types of regulations over the years that are intended to preserve the notion that local stations operate in a way that is reflective of and responsive to the needs and interests of their community of license. So this sort of centralization at the level of local news really does contradict that the localism principle.
Now, does that simply reflect an idea that so much of our political culture is getting nationalized? I mean, local news still exists, and so do local communities, to be sure. But we've all seen how much the national political debate and the polarization has become nationalized. Why shouldn't local news follow suit?
I think one of the dangers, and this is one of the issues that came out of the election and the discussion of how news has become nationalized, is that local perspectives, local takes, news that does reflect the unique characteristics of local communities really does get lost in the shuffle. And then the other key criteria that we've traditionally applied in our media regulatory framework, and that's the issue of diversity. And do we see diverse viewpoints? Voters have access to diverse and antagonistic sources that help them to make well-informed decisions?
Now, let's step back for a second and take a look at Sinclair's size and its power in the market. 193, I think, stations that Sinclair owns. How much have they grown in the past decade? And this number, 193, is it big? Is Sinclair really that powerful?
Well, there are 210, I believe the number is, television markets in the United States, distinct television markets. So if you own 193 stations, you have a fairly sizable footprint by the traditional standards of local TV. The ownership cap in our country's been expressed in terms of a national audience reach. And the audience cap as it currently exists is 39% of the national television audience. So with the number of stations that Sinclair owns and the way in which some of these stations and their audience reach is discounted because they are UHF stations, which means that their audience reach only counts for half of the community that they serve, their national footprint, as I understand it, gets closer to 73-74%, something like that.
Now, with that breadth of audience, though, I mean, how much reach does Sinclair really have? I guess the question there is, what's the denominator? How much news are Americans getting from the types of stations that Sinclair owns?
Right. Yeah, what that number doesn't tell us is how widely viewed these stations are in the communities that they serve. Not knowing what the ratings are across all these stations, one thing we do know is that very recent survey research, and this is sort of surprising, I think, people still identify local television news as one of their primary sources of news. So in terms of how people self-report their news consumption, local TV news still ranks very high.
So people are still watching it. Is that primarily older people, whereas younger people get their news from the internet or from social media?
The demographics of local TV news do tend to skew a bit older, yeah.
So what's the main concern for you, Philip, when you saw that supercut video? Not only were all these anchors delivering the exact same message, but they were delivering a message that attacked other media outlets and seemed to be hand in glove with the message of the White House.
Right. And there are a few concerns here. I think one is that local TV has been regulated traditionally in a way to try to preserve some of the characteristics that are essentially lost on other platforms. When we talk about the internet, we talk about social media as a way that we get news. The reality is that national news tends to overwhelm local news in people's news consumption. That's why Facebook tweaked their algorithm recently to try to figure out a way to increase the likelihood that people will consume local news. We lose one of our last bastions, really, of true local reporting, of independent decision making happening at the local level as it relates to news. We've been lucky in the sense that local TV news has not yet suffered the massive economic hardships that, for example, local newspapers have. So as no local newspapers have gone away and the hyperlocals have really failed to provide an adequate substitute, local TV news was sort of the last man standing as far as local journalism goes. And this obviously takes a lot of the local out of journalism.
What's to be done here, if anything? Is there a role for regulation? Is there any way that a regulator could step in and say this runs afoul of what local news is supposed to be? Or is this just what you get when you have a political culture that's nationalized and a company that knows how to make money off of the current moment?
The traditional safeguard has been ownership regulations that limit the national reach of any one company. Those are in the process of being relaxed even more than they already are. There's that defensive mechanism of maintaining some ownership regulations that don't allow this to get worse. Sinclair is in the process of purchasing Tribune Company stations, in which case their reach would expand further. And again, this isn't about the nature of the message. This is about just decentralization of control of the process of producing journalism and keeping people informed. Now, on the other hand, on the content side, which is something that is always a very sticky conversation in this country, if this sort of content does or were to sort of veer into the realm of disinformation, to use the term that we're all sick of, fake news, there actually are rules, FCC rules against that as it pertains to local TV stations, that if there is evidence of intentional production and dissemination of false information, that is supposed to trigger an FCC investigation. Those rules have been around since the 60s. They're not anything we hear much about because they're so seldom employed.
So, Philip, what's the caveat emptor here from you, if to the extent that people want to hear it, if they're watching local news on a Sinclair station? Certainly they can watch the news they want and take from it what they will. And you would say what?
I would say that there isn't any component of our news ecosystem anymore that seems to be immune to the politicization that has affected journalism in recent years, that someone seeking out objective reporting needs to work hard and needs to be more informed about the nature of their news sources than perhaps they ever have been, because it's getting tougher and tougher to find what at least traditional journalists would say is objective, politically neutral reporting.
Philip Napoli is a professor at Duke Sanford School of Public Policy. Professor, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that's our show today. If you missed anything, including our big look at the alleged chemical attacks in Syria over the weekend, you can catch up on the Takeaways podcast. Be sure to download it. Thanks for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Got a comment for the show? Hit us up on our Facebook page, tweet us at The Takeaway, or leave us a voicemail at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Your ideas and takes are a huge part of who we are. Let us know what you're thinking about. This is The Takeaway.
Scott Pruitt's ethical lapses aired out on Fox News.
Have you made mistakes?
I think this is something that needs to be corrected.
And it was a mistake.
It was a mistake by my team.
By your team. So do you take responsibility?
I'm fixing the problem.
Mistakes by the head of the EPA catch up to him, but will he keep his job? That's next time on the Takeaway Podcast.